Radio.
And welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms, through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Welcome to Nature Spirituality with Selena Fox. This is Selena Fox, and we are having a special podcast and Facebook live stream tonight. Today is August 26th, and since 1973 in the USA, this has been called Women's Equality Day. This year, in 2020, this also happens to be the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution becoming law. It got ratified on August 18th, 1920, and then after a series of additional processes, it got certified on August 26th. And in 1971, the move began to commemorate this important milestone for women in their quest for women's equality. And Congress finally in 1973 authorized August 26th as Women's Equality Day. So it's great to be with all of you. I give thanks to all of you who are listening live via Circle Sanctuary's Internet Radio Network, CSNP. This is the Nature Spirituality Podcast that I do every week. And I give thanks to all of you who are watching and listening live via my main Facebook page, Selena Fox Updates. I would like to share with you tonight some history, or if you prefer, herstory, about the quest for women's equality and the quest in particular for voting rights. I give thanks to the Wild Hunt news blog, Pagan News Daily on the web. They invited me to share some thoughts and perspectives about women in the vote and this centennial. And just a short while ago, an article with some of the interview with me appeared, and more will appear tomorrow. And I also have been celebrating via social media and plan to put some additional information up in times to come. Well, what I'd like to do now is actually read to you the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Now, if you're from the USA, and I invite those of you who are on Facebook Live to let me know where you're watching from. Where in the U.S., if you're watching from the U.S., and I'm so thankful to see people from around the world also joining in, so share where you're watching from if it's another country. The U.S. Constitution has had a variety of amendments proposed and some adopted and becoming law over time, and the 19th Amendment took quite a journey to achieve. And I'll be sharing some of the timeline of the quest for women's suffrage in the USA, and also sharing with you some perspectives about women and voting rights across time and around the world. The 19th Amendment needed to be proposed and then passed by Congress, and then ratified by three-quarters of the states. And that finally was accomplished. Wisconsin became the first state to have all of its paperwork in order and to file it for ratification, and Tennessee was the final state to achieve that ratification. It's a simple amendment in terms of its wording. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So while there aren't many words to the 19th Amendment, there were many words that were part of the process of convincing people with political power, lawmakers, to move this forward. The United States was not the very first place to have voting rights for women. Indeed, over time, there have been voting rights for women in a variety of cultures. And while I won't dive deep in all of this, I do want to put this within the larger global context. Indeed, across time and space, in a number of societies, including right here in North America, women have had a voice in government. In particular, we know about the Iroquois Confederacy in some Native American nations and tribal groups. Women had political power, were on councils. But when it came to having universal suffrage in the U.S., that has been long and convoluted. And indeed, places like Hawaii, even before it became part of the U.S., for a time, women could vote there, but then the vote was taken away. And that was before Hawaii even became part of the USA. So I'd like to share with you some of the history of women getting the right to vote. Now, actually, the very first place in the world to award and maintain, so that's the critical factor here. Women have gotten the right to vote in some places, and then it's been taken away. Well, the very first place in the whole wide world that we know about where women got the right to vote and continued to have the right to vote was actually Wyoming, while it was still a territory. That was in 1869. And then in 1881, on the Isle of Man, which was a self-governing territory that was part of what was sometimes called the British Empire, women who owned property got the right to vote. So that was the first place in those isles where women got the right to vote. In 1893, New Zealand gave women the right to vote, and that's when it was a British colony. And as we move through different places, I will say that the International Women's Suffrage Alliance, IWSA, was formed in Berlin in Germany, and that was formed in 1904, which manifested the quest for voting and equal civil rights for women. In 1906, in Finland, which was part of Russia at the time, it was the first place in the world to have racially equal suffrage for women. And they got the right to vote and to run for public office. 1913, it was Norway, the first sovereign nation to award women the right to vote. In 1917, it was Canada. 1918, England, Great Britain. 1918, all of Germany. 1919, Australia and the Netherlands. And then in 1920, the U.S. finally had suffrage for women. Now, it was passed in 1920, and women did have the right to vote. However, why was the Voting Rights Act that John Lewis and other civil rights leaders backing passed in 1965? Well, that was the Voting Rights Act, and the reason that had to be passed is although the right to vote was available for women and men, and for people who were black and white, it was a universal suffrage in the USA, voting wasn't fully implemented everywhere in the country. And indeed, if you look at the movie Selma, I highly recommend it, which covers the work of Martin Luther King Jr. and John Lewis and a variety of civil rights leaders, male and female, you will see that illustrated there was the case of a woman played by Oprah who went to vote and was given all sorts of questions and quizzes and ridiculous things to have to explain and to give the correct answer for. And if you weren't able to do that, you couldn't register to vote. So that's an example of how, although there was voting granted, voting was not implemented. And I hope that before the U.S. Congress, as we speak, that some updates to the Voting Rights Act in the USA can finally make it through Congress. Indeed, there have been some erosions to voting rights in the USA over time, and it's been necessary to pass some additional legislation to not suppress the vote, but to encourage the vote, to really make it easy for all citizens to vote. And while we're talking about voting, before we do the deep dive in the timeline for the 19th Amendment, I will show you my mail-in ballot envelope. Yes, I have usually voted in every election since I had came of voting age, but I voted by absentee ballot for the first time in 2018 because I was speaking at an international conference on Parliament of the World's Religions in Canada, and so I cast my very first ballot by mail-in back in November of 2018. Well, earlier this year, 2020, I voted in the April primary election in Wisconsin, and I will say, voting during a pandemic has its own adventures. Fortunately, I live in a rural area, and there was lots of social distancing and good ways to be able to vote safely in person and no long lines. So I voted in April in person, but this summer, as the pandemic has gotten worse in the U.S., it became apparent to me and my husband and lots of other people that what we really need to do is get mail-in ballots. And so I did that. And in the most recent election, which wasn't that long ago, I actually not only voted by absentee ballot, but I used a ballot drop box that went straight to the town hall. So I continue to educate myself about voting and voting rights. And part of the reason for celebrating this centennial is it's really important to do some education when these milestones come by. Not only paying attention to what's happened in the past, but as we look towards the future, we want to make certain that we not only uphold the rights that we have, but we implement the rights that we have and keep our rights from being diminished, suppressed, or otherwise interfered with. And in saying this, I'm saying this in a multi-partisan way. I realize right now we're in an election year and there is a lot of discussion and, yes, debate and some ranting about the vote and some information that's correct and information that's not correct that's out there in the media, public media and in social media and other ways. It is safe and a good idea to vote by mail or by absentee ballot that you put into a ballot drop box. And indeed, there's places like Colorado that have been having everybody vote that way for years, safely, no fraud. So it's really important as those of us in the U.S. prepare for the election on November 3rd that we get informed and actually look at more than one source to get our information, to get information from good sources, and to be able to vote. So what was this long journey? Why did it take so long for women to get the right to vote in the USA? Indeed, back in the colonial era, as America was being born, women were calling for the vote then when the country was being formed. But women did not have the vote in 1776 as our country was born. Indeed, there have been many voices over time that have asked to vote, that have demanded to vote. So there are a number of different points along the way that have made a big difference in this quest for women's suffrage. And what I'd like to do now is read excerpts from the Declaration of Sentiments. It's also known as the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments. It's a document. It was signed in 1848. There was a convention held in Seneca Falls, New York. It's now known as the Seneca Falls Convention. And the main author of this declaration was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And she actually modeled this according to the Declaration of Independence. That was that thing that birthed our country in 1776. Another person that assisted her was Lucretia Coffin Mott and Martha Coffin Wright. And the North Star, which was published by Frederick Douglass, who also was a suffragist. Not all the suffragists were women. We had men as well as women. We had people of different racial connections that were all part of this grand quest. And Douglass actually helped pass the resolution, and he said that it was the grand movement for attaining the civil, social, political, and religious rights of women. So here's the opening paragraph. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these rights, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it and to insist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object advances a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for the future security, such has been the patient sufferance of the women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpation on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Well, I'm not going to read all the sentiments, but I'll read a few of them that start out a long list. He has not ever permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise. He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she had no voice. He has withheld her from rights which are given to the most ignorant and degraded men, both natives and foreigners. And then, as we go through this long list, there are closing remarks. And you can find this whole declaration on the web in a variety of different places. In fact, I've got this from Wikipedia, Declaration of Sentiments. So the closing remarks. Now, in view of this entire disenfranchisement of one half the people of this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws above mentioned, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of these United States. In entering upon the great work before us, we anticipate no small amount of misconception, misrepresentation, and ridicule, but we shall use every instrumentality within our power to effect our object. We shall employ agents, circulate tracts, petition the state and national legislatures, and endeavor to enlist the pulpit and the press in our behalf. We hope this convention will be followed by a series of conventions embracing every part of the country. And indeed, women and men signed this. Lucretia Mott was the first one. The sister of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Harriet Cady Eaton, signed it. A variety of people signed on to this. Many people have marked this 1848 Seneca Falls Convention as the real starting place for the move for women's suffrage. And indeed, that is part of the journey. Prior to that, in 1840, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they were barred from attending the World Anti-Slavery Convention, which was held in London. And that prompted them to hold a women's convention in the U.S. Now, why were they barred? Because they were female. And you will find, and I'm going to share some of the points along the way of this quest for women's suffrage, but you will find intersectionality happening in the 1800s and the 1900s before it became a common phrase within contemporary feminism. Indeed, you had many of the suffragists, which is what they were called in the U.S. In the U.K., there were suffragists there too, but there were also suffragettes who tended to be a bit more intense with their tactics for getting the vote in England. And indeed, there have been some excellent movies and documentary that have really looked at that quest for women getting the vote in England and getting the vote in the USA. So this Declaration of Sentiments was an important part of this very first Women's Rights Convention. In 1849, that was the very next year, the first state constitution in California extends property rights to women. 1850, in Massachusetts, the first National Women's Rights Convention there was held, and Frederick Douglass, Paula Wright Davis, Abby Keller Foster, William Lloyd Garrison, Lucy Stone, Sojourner Truth are all attending. And there was this great intersectionality where the quest to stop slavery, to abolish slavery, intersected with women getting the right to vote as well. And indeed, over time, their women were starting to get property rights, and then the Civil War happened from 1861 to 1865, and that created some delays in this momentum for getting voting rights, but people carried it on. And indeed, in 1866, right after the Civil War, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, they formed the American Equal Rights Association, and that's dedicated to the goal of suffrage for all, regardless of gender or race. So here again, you see early on there's a quest for racial equality as well as gender equality regarding voting. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and then another person called Parker Pillsbury, they published the very first edition of The Revolution. And this had the motto, this periodical, men, their rights, and nothing more. Women, their rights, and nothing less. Indeed, the momentum continued to build. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton became very close friends and worked together for over 50 years on women's suffrage, along with a variety of other people. I'd like to share with you some names so that you are aware of some of the hundreds of women and men who contributed to this successful quest of women's suffrage. These are just a few of them. Susan B. Anthony is well known as one of the prime movers of this suffrage quest. She was born in 1820 and died in 1906. So she did not live to see the quest succeed. However, many people recognized the important work that she was doing. In fact, the 19th Amendment was also known for many years as the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. She was the co-founder and leader of the National Women's Suffrage Association. She was one of the leaders of the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And she was a great organizer and strategist. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she was great at writing, and the two of them made a great team. Susan B. Anthony was born into a Quaker family that valued social equality, so it was hardwired in her own consciousness as she emerged. When she was 17, she collected anti-slavery petitions, and she met Elizabeth Cady Stanton a few years later in 1851, and they were involved in the Temperance Society, so that was another whole dynamic and connection. And regardless of your views on alcohol, essentially it served its purpose of bringing people together and helping to raise awareness about the needs of women in society. Indeed, part of the reason that temperance organizing got mixed into this is that women had no voice, they had no voting rights, and in many places they could not even own property, they couldn't get credit, if they were widowed, if they came into money, they inherited money, and they married again, all of their lands and their money and their property went to their husbands. So there were some really gross inequalities that went on for years that gave rise to a lot of these activist movements. I would say that one of the most dramatic points in Susan B. Anthony's life was in 1872 when she was arrested for voting in Rochester, New York, where she lived, for Ulysses S. Grant in a presidential election. Indeed, there was a very public trial about this, and she couldn't defend herself. She wasn't allowed to speak because she was a woman. She did not get a good day in court, and of course, they found her guilty and fined her $100. She refused to pay the fine. Why? She did not want to give any credence whatsoever to this horrible judicial procedure that was exceedingly unfair. And she maintained that she had the right to vote and did nothing wrong, so therefore she did not need to be pardoned. This trial was a sham. Well, here we are in 2020. Let's put it this way. A lot of people have been looking to observe this centennial in a variety of ways. Well, there was a commission for the centennial that was formed. Indeed, Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, first woman who was elected to Congress. She first served in the House of Representatives, first woman from Wisconsin to do so, and then became the first woman from Wisconsin to serve in the U.S. Senate. And I want to give thanks to her for the work that she and other people in her office did during the Pentacle Quest, the quest for equal rights for pagans, and getting our religious emblem on a list of emblems of belief that can be on gravestones that the VA issues for deceased veterans. she and her staff were exceedingly helpful, and she really has worked across the aisles. And while she's a Democrat, she has worked and collaborated with Republicans and has really been about bringing people together. Well, she felt it was really important to observe this centennial, so she proposed having this commission to observe it, and indeed got every woman in the U.S. Senate to approve this, to sign on as co-sponsors of it, Republicans and Democrats. And I just think that is so excellent. So the culmination of the centennial observations had a variety of events, and indeed on the 100th anniversary of the final vote to ratify from Tennessee on August 18, 2020, the commission, she wasn't part of the commission, nor were the other senators, but the group went to the White House to go and get the presidential signature, basically celebrating the centennial. So that was a good thing. Something that was not well thought out or done appropriately was, in addition to being there and having the proclamation for this grand celebration, there was a decision to pardon Susan B. Anthony. Susan B. Anthony is not amused, according to the one that runs her museum in New York. And if you want more information about that, you can read part two of my interview with The Wild Hunt tomorrow, August 27th. Indeed, quite a few people were extremely upset at this move. So instead of being something that really celebrated Susan B. Anthony, it actually was something that had the opposite effect for some people. So I don't know what the sentiments were that led to this ill-conceived attempt to pardon Susan B. Anthony, but essentially it upset a lot of people. So I guess what else is new these days? There is diversity of opinion. Where do I stand on all of this? Well, here are the facts. Susan B. Anthony got pardons for the election officials that permitted her to vote. She refused to get a pardon for herself. So there was a window where she could have tried to make that happen. She did not make that happen. Should she have been pardoned? I don't think so, because to do so undercuts her whole premise that the whole trial to begin with was a sham. But you'll have to make your own choice about that. Who else was part of this grand quest to get the vote for women? Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I've talked with you already about her. She was born in 1815 and died in 1902. She was out of New York. Besides being the author of this declaration, she had a lot of legal expertise. How did that happen? Well, she actually not only had schooling at home, but she went to Emma Willard's Troy Female Seminary and graduated in 1832. She studied law in the office of her father. Who was her father? But a U.S. congressman, Daniel Cady. He also became a Supreme Court judge in New York. And she married an attorney, Henry Stanton, who was not only an attorney, but an abolitionist. She insisted when they got married that the marriage vows that urged women to obey their husband, she got rid of that obey word. So as you can tell, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was also fairly feisty about this. she and her husband went to the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London, and she saw firsthand that official recognition to some women delegates was denied because they were women, and that included Lucretia Mott. And so she and Lucretia connected there. Indeed, she, Stanton, Anthony, and Mott are all commemorated in Statuary Hall at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., with a sculpture out of marble. It's all three women are emerging out of this block of stone, but the stone is not totally finished. You know, they're emerging out of it. The woman that designed and sculpted that said the reason being that she left it unfinished was that although women got the right to vote, there was still a long way to go for equality. There was great celebration when this monument was unveiled in Statuary Hall and the vote for women became law. There was great celebrations. But then what happened after the celebration? Within days, this glorious monument got removed from Statuary Hall and put in the basement of the Capitol, in the crypt, where it stayed until the mid-90s, when enough women were then now in elected office on Capitol Hill that they made a great cry about this, and lo and behold, that wonderful monument to the suffragists came out of basement residence back up to Statuary Hall. There was a lot of hullabaloo about that. I'm happy to say that for this centennial, the colors of purple and gold, which were among the colors associated with the suffragists, ribbons of purple and gold were draped on this monument in Statuary Hall. I've seen some pictures of it decorated. The commission was part of the works behind that. So how do I know this story? Well, earlier this year, before the pandemic was declared a pandemic, it was early January, I was on the East Coast in Washington, D.C., taking part in a series of national chaplaincy conferences, as I do every year. And I always build in a few extra days so I can go and visit some sites. So I went to the U.S. Capitol because I knew there was a women's suffrage exhibit there. And I took the tour, the Votes for Women Centennial Tour around the Capitol. And indeed, there are some other statues of suffragists there. Sojourner Truth is there. Jeanette Rankin is there. Frances Willard is there. Just really, it was a wonderful tour. Now, of course, now the pandemic is happening, and we don't have the in-person visitation as we did in January. But the good news is there are a number of these exhibits celebrating women getting the right to vote. And I want to recommend the online exhibit version of Rightfully Hers. This is the exhibit that I saw a year ago in August of 2019 at the National Archives. They have a variety of artifacts that date back during that whole quest for suffrage. They even have an interactive part where you can go into a voting booth and select particular issues that are important to you and to cast your vote for what you consider important issues are. So it's a really fabulous exhibit. And while the whole thing isn't online, there's quite a bit of information there, and I'd invite you to go and seek that out. So what are some of the other people who were part of this. I mentioned Lucretia Mott, born 1793 and died in 1880. She was born in Massachusetts and died in Pennsylvania, and she was very much into social reform. And she helped found the women's rights movement in the USA. And how did she get involved? Well, she learned as part of her education to teach. She became a teacher, and she found out that because she was female, she only got half the salary of the men who were teaching. This radicalized her. And indeed, in my own life, as I dealt with inequality in higher education, colleges and universities, in multiple accounts, that led me not only to be aware of this, but motivated me to get active and make some changes. So Lucretia became the president of the American Equal Rights Association in 1866, and she and her husband opened their home to runaway slaves as part of the Underground Railroad. So I think it's time to talk about Harriet Tubman. Now, many people know about Harriet Tubman because she was sometimes known as Moses. She helped free slaves, not only people in her own family, but others. She was enslaved herself, and she ran away. If you have not yet seen the excellent and fairly recent movie Harriet, I strongly recommend it. It's a very good summary of her life, particularly looking at her work for racial equality and the abolition of slavery. It talks about her early life. It shows her and her courage as well as her mystical guidance. How did she get mystical guidance? Well, some say in her youth, age 12, 13 or so, unfortunately, she received beatings because she was helping somebody who was enslaved, and it cracked her head open, and she really had a horrible time of it and actually had migraines for much of the rest of her life. And some say that might be why she had some epileptic seizures at times. But she had visions. She was a deeply spiritual woman. So while she is known as the conductor of the Underground Railroad, she also has some distinctions that some people are less aware of. She was the first African-American woman to serve in the U.S. military. Indeed, she was a Union spy. And indeed, she even was part of a way of freeing 700 enslaved people at a camp. And indeed, she was about equality, liberty, and justice for all. Less known is the fact that she was a suffragist and was close friends of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Another important African-American woman who was a suffragist is Sojourner Truth. She was an excellent speaker, also an abolitionist. Ida B. Wells Barnett, she was born in 1862 and died in 1931. She was an African-American newspaper editor and journalist, and she was an early leader in civil rights movement. Who are some of the other people that we should remember? Matilda Jocelyn Gage, 1826 to 1898. And I should say Sojourner Truth was born in actually 1797 and died in 1883. Harriet Tubman, there's some debate about when she was born, 1822, seems to be the best year. Some have said 1820, but more recent research has shown it 1822, and she died in 1813. Lucy Stone, she was gave a speech that actually got Susan B. Anthony inspired to be a suffragist. Lucy Stone was born in 1818 and died in 1893. Alice Paul, 1885, and died in 1977. Indeed, how do I come to know about Alice Paul? She crafted the Equal Rights Amendment. What is the Equal Rights Amendment? Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. The amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Well, the Equal Rights Amendment was another attempt to get gender equality in the U.S. Constitution. I was part of that particular quest, and indeed, I worked for a time when I first came to Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin in Madison for Catherine, also known as Kay Clarenbach, who helped birth the National Organization of Women. I worked with her. I was her executive assistant, and we did a variety of different things as part of our work together at the University of Wisconsin, and then there were side projects as well, and part of it, she helped birth got the governor of Wisconsin to create a commission on the status of women. Indeed, JFK had created the National Commission Status of Women, which Eleanor Roosevelt headed up. And so in Wisconsin, we had our own continuation of this quest for equality. Although the ERA made it through Congress and ratification was starting to happen, it failed to be ratified, lacked the votes from three states. When you look at the wording of the ERA, it's really not much different than that of the 19th Amendment, but it's basically granting rights across the board to women, equal rights. It is my hope that that someday, or its equivalent, will be passed, where gender equality is indeed guaranteed in all sectors. Who are some of the other suffragists that were part of this quest? Lucy Burns, she worked with Alice Paul. She was born in 1879 and died in 1966. Helen Taft, she was the daughter of President William Howard Taft, and she was very involved in pro-suffrage speeches. She was born in 1891. And died in 1987. Frances Willard, 1839 to 1898, and she was involved with Women's Christian Temperance and the International Council of Women. And of course, there's Amelia Bloomer. Have you heard of bloomers? Yes, she didn't invent bloomers, but she popularized them, and this women's right and temperance activist actually is immortalized by that piece of clothing. Olympia Brown, 1835 to 1926, the first woman to graduate from a theological school and the first full-time ordained minister, also an activist for women's rights. And it's great that she lived long enough to see that the vote was obtained for women. And then, of course, there's Victoria Woodhull, 1838 to 1927. She was the first woman to speak before a committee of Congress, the first female candidate for president of the USA, and one of the first women in the USA to start a weekly labor reform, a weekly newspaper, and she was involved with labor reform as well. Well, these are just a few of the many women, and there are also men who were part of this quest. I am so glad that this quest met success. Along the way, there was much debate, discussion, and people kind of varied in their various tactics and how to make all of this happen. Some women really took on President Wilson, who initially was opposed to women's suffrage. They chained themselves to the gates, the fence around the White House in Washington, D.C. Eventually, their actions, hunger strikes, getting force-fed, similar to what happened to suffragettes in England, all of the, not only these acts, basically saying we must get our rights, were important, but the publicity around these acts were important. Indeed, some suffragists in the U.S. actually recognized that by doing some peaceful civil disobedience, that would get them in trouble. And some were so clever that they actually got a press photographer to hide in a cupboard, and when they came to be arrested, cupboard open, news journalist with camera takes picture, front page, news about these suffragists. So there were some excellent tactics that were not violent, but very visible, that helped with this quest. One of the turning points as suffrage started to be achieved was in 1913. There was a grand march down some of the main roads in Washington, D.C., this huge suffragist march. And there was a need to bring increasingly attention to this quest. So what finally did it to get the U.S. to give women the vote? Well, some say part of it had to do with things happening in other parts of the world, in particular England, because women got the vote there a couple years before women in the U.S. did. But part of it had to do with World War I, and indeed, that was such a transforming event that it literally changed society. Well, here we are, little more than 100 years later, and at the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote, and what, you know, back in 1918, there was this horrible flu. It's called the Spanish flu, but it wasn't really originating in Spain. It actually... Spain just didn't have as much silence of their media reporting this, so therefore that's how it got that branding. But essentially, we're in a pandemic right now, and clearly a lot of the inequalities in American society are being more visible, and people are in the streets in various ways. It is my hope that we can take lessons from the past, and in particular from the quest for racial equality that Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, and others were part of, the work with nonviolent, peaceful protest, but visible protest, can get a lot done. Yes, it might take a while, but unfortunately, when violence enters a quest for equality, it complicates things and too often is used by the opposition as an excuse to delay the achievement of that quest further. So I invite all of you, as you look towards the past, this centennial of the quest for women's suffrage, that we also look to the future. Look for ways that we not only can continue to uphold the vote, but to have voting be even better for everyone. And what is even more important, I think, is the fact that we have to respect those who help win the vote, and one of the best ways of doing that is to vote. To register to vote, find out about the voting process, find out about issues and candidates, make your choices, and vote. It is more important this year, 2020, in the USA, than any of the other years I've ever voted. There is a lot in play. I'm not going to say who to vote for, but I do encourage you to do your research. Look at candidates that truly want equality, liberty, and justice for all. Look at candidates that are going to support not only women's rights, but gender equality, whatever the gender identity is. Look at candidates that are going to support taking rights, because not everybody in public office cares about that, wants that to be the reality. So yes, I'm an activist on many fronts. I've worked for racial equality, women's equality, LGBTQ equality, and many other social justice causes. Why? Well, I have been called to do this work, and I invite you all in your own way to find ways to be part of the solution, not the toxic pollution that oppresses people and keeps our society enslaved to outmoded ways of being. We need to be free. We need to have a healthier, happier society. Well, there is a lot to be reflected on at this time of the centennial. I encourage you to take this podcast and this Facebook live stream as a starting place, not as just a summary of everything. I hope that it has given you some information about some of the many adventures along the way for women's suffrage, some of the people that made it possible. Recognize that each of us can help affect change. Thank you all for tuning in, and thanks to our Circle Sanctuary Internet Radio team for CSNP, Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast, Jeanette and David Ewing, who manage and engineer this show, and we have Deborah Rose and Laura Gonzalez, who along with the Ewings also have podcasts. Check out all the podcasts that we do, and I invite you to continue to celebrate achievements, to be hopeful about working for even a better reality in times to come. And remember to vote. Thank you all for tuning in. And after this podcast, I'll be taking a look at your comments and things you posted in my Facebook live stream thread. And if you have questions or comments, I invite you to give feedback. It's really wonderful to be able to be part of this celebration. And I invite you to envision purple and gold, or if you have some candles with those colors, to kindle them yet tonight as part of this grand celebration. Many blessings, and may there be equality, liberty, and justice for all, now and in times to come, here in the USA and around the world and beyond. Blessed be.
Really no big deal. And this is Everyday Guys.
She's a mother off to work. She is driving in her car. She's a goddess in the elevator, rising like a star. They say she's working like a man, but they don't understand. She's dancing with the goddess in her heart.
Sanctuary Network Podcasts, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNPodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.